Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Administrative Law and Regulation and Litigation Practice Groups, was recorded on Monday, April 23, 2018, during a live Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we are hosting a Courthouse Steps discussion on Lucia v. SEC following the oral argument, which was held earlier today. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Professor Gregory Dolan, who is the co-director of the Center for Medicine and Law at University of Baltimore School of Law. Also with us is Kevin B. Mullendorf, who is a partner at Wiley Ryan Law Firm. After hearing from our speakers today, we'll move to an audience Q&A. So, as they're speaking, please keep in mind what questions you would have for them or for the case in general. Thank you both for speaking with us today. Professor, the floor is yours to begin.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to be back on one of these conference calls, so thank you so much for hosting me. And I look forward to talking about this case and potentially fielding any questions. I will just give one quick disclaimer that I was not able to attend the oral argument in person, so I'm going off of a transcript that I did get a chance to read from start to finish. So let me just, before we dive into the actual argument, let me just set up the question and sort of the issue presented to the court in this case. The question before the court was, who is an officer of the United States versus who is an employee of the United States? And the reason that matters is that the Constitution provides for a particular mode of appointment of officers. And furthermore, there are two types of officers. There's the principal officers, the ones that are kind of often in the news, the Attorney General, the Secretary of Commerce, so all the cabinet officials, ambassadors, judges, heads of various independent agencies like CFPB, or in this case, obviously the SEC. And they're appointed in the way kind of we oftentimes notice. They're appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. But then there are also inferior officers that the Constitution allows the president to appoint without senatorial consent, and even allows these appointments to be made not just by the president, but by the heads of the department or by the judges. So, for example, magistrate judges are these types of inferior officers. They're appointed without presidential authority, without senatorial consent, by various judges in their districts. And so the question in this case was whether administrative law judges, which are types of judges that are adjudicate matters arising out of the administrative state between usually the government and the citizens, whether these are officers or employees. In the context of the SEC, these judges conduct hearings. So whenever SEC decides to take any enforcement actions because they think somebody committed a fraud upon the public or violated any other SEC rules or statutes, they can choose to take that person to court or the company to court, or they can bring the action internally within their agency and seek enforcement there. And if they go with option number two, the case is usually heard first by the administrative law judge, and then when the decision is made, it can be reviewed by the commission overall, the bipartisan commission. Sometimes they are reviewed, sometimes they are not, and if they are not, the decision of the administrative law judge becomes final. The way this case came up is because the administrative law judges are appointed not by the commission itself, so the commissioners don't pick, but instead they're appointed from a list of qualified individuals provided by the Merit Systems Protection Board to the chief administrative judge, and chief administrative judge, who, again, obviously is not a commissioner, gets to pick who will serve and who will adjudicate matters for the commission. These judges are vested with powers to hold hearings, take evidence, rule on objections, enter default judgments and enter reports and so write reports and including findings of facts and conclusions of law, which become final unless the commission decides to modify them in whole or in part. And so the question presented to this court was whether or not exercising such power makes the ALJ, in fact, an officer which has to be appointed not by a chief administrative law judge, but by the commission or by some other superior officer of the United States. The petitioners relied on the case called Freytag, which concluded in a similar situation that certain judges of the tax court, even though their decisions could be reviewed by the primary judges, were in fact officers and had to be appointed by inconsistent with the appointments clause of the Constitution. Government actually, after the election of President Trump, changed his position and agreed with the petitioners, saying that in fact these are officers, whereas before they took a position that they're not. And so the Supreme Court appointed an amicus to argue in defense of the judgment below, arguing that these ALJs are not officers based on the theory that they're not acting in their own name. They don't bind anybody unless and until the commission issues an order of finality. Additional argument that was presented as to why the ALJs are not in fact officers was because the statute creating the SEC allowed the commissioner to delegate its authority to either a single commissioner or to ALJs. So the argument was presented that in any case, because of either the review possibility or because of the statutory language, the ALJ is not acting in his own name or in the name of his own office, but in the name of the commission, which makes sort of in the view of the amicus defendant judgment below, makes all the difference. I'll make one more point before I turn it over to my colleague about how this case came up. This appointment was challenged in front of the commission, which decided that it could not adjudicate such matters. And so ultimately, a petition review was filed with the D.C. Circuit. The petitioners lost in the D.C. Circuit, obviously. They filed an en banc review petition. The court split 5-5. This was the time when Chief Judge Garland was not participating, because I think at the time his nomination to the Supreme Court was still pending. So the court split 5-5, leaving the panel decision standing. A Supreme Court petition for review was filed, cert was filed, and in the meantime, the 10th Circuit reached an exact opposite conclusion. So the D.C. Circuit held that ALJs are not officers, they're merely employees and therefore do not need to be appointed consistent with the Appointments Clause, where the 10th Circuit held the exact opposite. And of course, 10th Circuit is Justice Gorsuch's old circuit. Petition for en banc hearing was filed there. But while that was pending, so Justice Gorsuch did not participate in that matter either, because by that point he was already elevated to the Supreme Court. And so now we have a circuit split coming to the Supreme Court from the 10th Circuit and from the D.C. Circuit. It was, I think, a lively argument, but at least to begin describing it, I think I'll turn it over to Kevin.
Yeah, thanks. It's Kevin Mollendorf again with Wiley Ryan. It was a good argument. I was grateful to get to attend. One of the things that was just pointed out was that the government had switched sides, which the cynic in me says it's because the SEC has a 9-0 losing streak in the last three cases before the Supreme Court. You look at Gabelli and then Kokesh and then Digital Realty Trust. They lost all of those, and so the cynic in me says that they switched sides so they could win one. But I think the arguments were sort of fascinating, and there were a couple times throughout the arguments where you could see, at least I think you could see, where the court was heading. The case, there is a case out there, the Freytag case, which is about the tax court judges, the special tax court judges, and at one point during the government's argument, I believe it was during the amicus argument, Justice Kagan asked, well, can't you, if you line up the top 10 attributes of the Freytag judges and the ALJs here, aren't you 9-10? And I don't know how she calculated that, but her point was, how are the ALJs here different from the Freytag judges that were found to be officers? And I don't think there was a very good argument in response. The response was, well, the ALJs can't bind, and the Freytag judges had the ability to bind, although I think the judge in that case, or at least the part of Freytag in that case that was at issue, didn't bind anyone. But it then devolved into a discussion about the Warren Commission and the Warren Commission, how clearly those commissioners weren't officers, even though they could do the same sort of things the ALJs could, and which just seemed to be off point. And I think that was maybe Justice Kagan's point there. And if Justice Kagan is going this way, was siding with the petitioners here, I think that's a good indication of where we're going. Another sort of point in rebuttal that was raised was Chief Justice Roberts asking amicus, the court has never held that an adjudicatory official is not an officer. Would you agree? And the amicus was forced to agree that's actually correct. And again, in sort of trying to what I would think is sort of a fade away from where the Chief Justice was going, compared it to the situation of a court of appeals case where cert's denied, and said, well, that's not you wouldn't think that is your denial of cert where the court of appeals case stands is it leaves the court of appeals opinion in place. That's that court of appeals opinion. It's not the Supreme Court's opinion. Sort of trying to analogize that to, well, if the ALJ's decision is not addressed by the commission, which it isn't 90% of the time, then it becomes the final law. That didn't seem to track very well. So I think again, Chief Justice Roberts was onto something there by saying, well, every time we've looked at this, it's come out that someone who makes an adjudication is in fact an inferior officer. That issue of adjudication seemed to be come up a lot during the argument. It came up a lot in where several of the justices wanted to know how an ALJ is different than just your average civil servant. Several times during the discussion, there were lengthy back and forths about, well, what about this kind of civil servant and what about that kind of civil servant, and how do we draw the line? And the petitioner's answer made some inherent sense. It's that the difference between an employee, some civil servant who goes out and does inspections or investigations, and someone who can summon you in against your will and make you and find against you and ban you for life, as was the case with Mr. Lucia, that is a far more serious thing and more of a sovereign, acting like a sovereign than just acting like an employee. Any questions so far? Greg, you want to?
So let me, I guess, just add some more things that perhaps to try to rehabilitate the amicus, because I think there were some questions that were also very hard for the petitioner. And I think while it's true that if Justice Kagan goes with the petitioner, that's a good indicator where the court will go. On the other hand, if Justice Kennedy, I suppose, goes with respond or with the amicus, with the SEC, that is also potentially an indicator. And so I think at least Justice Breyer and Kagan and Kennedy, one of the questions that they kept coming back to, and of course it's a fool's errand to predict whether any of this will matter in terms of final opinion, but it was sort of an interesting refrain, I suppose, is this question of independence of the ALJs, independence in rendering decisions. So the concern was that if the ALJs become more closely associated, more closely tied with the commission or any other similar body, if they become appointed by that body, that they may feel as if that their jobs depend on their appointing authority and therefore will be less likely to be independent and rule against the commission or any sort of entity that actually appointed them. And that would sort of work in cross purposes to Mr. Lucia's argument suggesting that that he got a raw deal in the hearing. Now, on the facts of this particular case, and perhaps on the facts of ALJs in front of SEC generally, I think petitioners did a good job in their briefing. It didn't come up in the argument, but in the briefing saying that this independence is somewhat illusory, the commission wins over 90% of the cases that it brings before the ALJs, which is why they've stopped pretty much going to federal court. They only go internally. But since the Supreme Court obviously decides matters not just for Mr. Lucia, but overall, I think this concern about independence, which both the government and the petitioner tried to allay, saying there's a difference between appointment independence and adjudicatory independence, the idea that the commission will never be able to interfere in any given case, but can choose to hire and fire people in a somewhat different manner, was raised. But I think this concern about independence and whether it's a better overall for adjudication and for litigants and for the fairness of the system to have ALJs be kind of separate and not be appointed by the very body that they have to then rule potentially against was, I think, fairly palpable. How it ultimately comes out, of course, like I said, it's a losing proposition to predict, but I thought that that was an important point that was sort of that several justices kept coming back to.
You know, I think that's definitely correct. I think the quote from Justice Kagan, or at least what I wrote down, was, wouldn't greater political accountability make your perception of bias worse? In other words, aren't we better off with them being more independent rather than being tied to the commission itself? And I think the response to that, though, was pretty powerful. Was, you know, the notion that you could have someone adjudicate a decision, fine, you know, ban you for life, or issue you a fine, and then have the SEC say, well, we didn't hire him; he was hired by OPM. Was the response, which has some inherent appeal, I thought. On that 90% figure I cited, one thing that was I think, if I'm remembering right, the first time that Justice Sotomayor jumped in was to challenge that 90% figure. The 90% figure that most of the ALJ opinions are summarily finalized. Commissioner Jackson, who I think is the newest SEC commissioner, has done some statistical analysis on that and found that, of course, that's true, but most of those cases are 12J actions from the SEC where they're getting rid of shell companies and things like that, that where nobody appears. And so that statistic of a 90% approval rate for ALJ decisions, I think, is probably not right, because that does seem a little inflated if you take the 12J actions into account.
There are two 90% figures. I think they're both just very high, in the high 90s. The one is, I think, that you just mentioned, and I think that was a good catch, both, again, in the briefs and also by Justice Sotomayor, that the 90% – so the petitioners argued that ALJs are really officers in part because 90% of the time their opinions are not reviewed and become final kind of its own. But as was just mentioned, that's part of the reason, because of those 90% of the time, most of the time review is not even sought, because nobody appears, these are shell companies and so on. But conversely, every time review is sought, it is granted. But there's a second 90% figure, sort of separate and apart from that, is that whether or not something is ultimately reviewed later on, the question how often in a contested case does ALJ rule for the government versus for the versus for the party that's brought before the commission. And I think that is also somewhere in low 90s or maybe high 80s, I don't remember the exact percentage, but it was cited in one of the briefs. And so what I was saying earlier is that on one hand, there's this real concern as to if you bring these ALJs, if you have commissioners hire them, and Justice Kagan did bring it up saying, there's several ways to control decisions. One is certainly saying you must rule X, and, you know, that's obviously the most blatant one. The other kind of the next down the line is if you don't rule X, we're going to dock your pay. And so that obviously would be so also fairly blatant. But then Justice Kagan suggested if you give the commission the power to hire people and they only hire the quote-unquote right type of people, the people who they are confident how they're going to rule, you know, the message will get out. And so that, although it may not necessarily affect every case immediately, but it will affect cases down the line, and that's bad for judicial or this quasi-judicial independence. And so I think the response to it may be, as it wasn't really brought up in the argument, but as the court sits down to write the opinion, it may be that this independence may very well be ephemeral, because when decisions actually do come down, whether or not they're ultimately reviewed by the commission or whether or not they're modified by the commission, ALJ seems to be consistently ruling in favor of the investigatory arm of the commission. Now, it could all be, of course, selection bias that the answer could be, well, because investigators don't bring bad cases. They only bring cases that are very solid. And, of course, so they're going to win most of the time. But that does sort of give pause, I think, raise some sort of doubt about the claims that this adjudicatory independence is that important, because it does not seem to actually, it does not actually seem to be playing out in real world.
Yeah, I mean, I used to work at the commission, and I now defend some of those cases. I can assure you that there are definitely some bad cases brought out there, which is why the appearance of independence is fairly important. After Dodd-Frank passed, there was and the ALJs were given more powers, or more remedies were available to the enforcement division through the ALJs. There was a noticeable increase in how many people and how many cases went there. But I'm not sure the statistics have borne out that those turn out to be a better place for them. I think, in fact, recently the SEC has done better in district court in insider trading cases than they had in the commission. But one of the things that you and I talked about before the call that I think was really interesting, and that came up throughout the argument, was this notion of, well, okay, if it's about the ability to bind the government, if that's one of the parts of the test, then what happens with your average AUSA, your line attorney, or an FBI agent? An AUSA can be in a litigating position and has the ability to bind the government. You make a decision whether to call a witness, or you make a decision to drop a charge, or not make an argument. That certainly binds the government. And does that then make a line AUSA an officer? Because an inferior officer, because though he's supervised, he had the ability to do something to bind the government. And I think the answer probably is, it was funny. If you look at, I'm looking at my appointment when I was at DOJ, I'm looking at the certificate on the wall, and it specifically says I'm appointed by the Attorney General to do such and such and such and such, to try cases. So it looks like that was an official delegation by the Attorney General within the limited parameters that I was allowed to do things. But every time I filed something, and every indictment was, I signed it, but it was on behalf of the chief of the section or the AAG or whatever the document said. So it was always sort of based on a delegated authority. I never really had the authority to do anything outside of my lane. And that came up throughout the argument, which I thought was kind of interesting.
And I thought so too, and I think sort of the argument, so it went back and forth again with Justice Kagan and Justice Alito as well, and there was this question as to what do we do with line attorneys, I think the amicus dissenting judgment below was saying just that it's a question of whose name are you speaking. Are you speaking in your own name, or speaking in the name of somebody, a superior officer? But what's interesting is then what Justice Alito kept pressing on is then, where do we look at for this delegation? In other words, is it because the Attorney General on his own accord decided to delegate to this person or that person or this office or that office? And is it how much the AG delegated on his own accord that makes somebody an officer? Or is it based on what the statute allows the SG or AG to delegate? Because if it's the former, then everything is somewhat the concern was that everything is somewhat manipulable, because the AG can, or whoever is the head of the relevant department, can basically decide today I'm going to delegate this much and tomorrow I'm going to delegate that much, and basically the courts will always be chasing their own tail, because you'll never know exactly who is the officer and who is not. Conversely, if it's statutory permission for the head of the department to delegate something, then it'll be just easier. You can just look at the statute and say, like, well, if the statute allows this much delegation, you're an officer, but if it's only that much, you're an employee. But there was no real clear resolution. And what was also found interesting about the AUSA is that there's actually a statute that makes AUSA appointable specifically by the Attorney General, the head of the department, because they are inferior officers, and that's 28 U.S.C. 542. And yet everybody seem to concede that AUSAs are not officers, which is somewhat odd in light of the statute, in light of the way they're appointed. But I think the concern was actually broader. It's not just about AUSA. It's also about what happens down the line in terms of if Lucia wins, what happens to other ALJs and what happens to other government attorneys and people who can take sort of significant, powerful steps. So I think there was some concern as to, you know, what will happen if Lucia wins. And that's actually, although the government and the petitioner were on the same side, that's where they parted company. So the government thought that, or argued that, the SEC can simply ratify the appointment of ALJs that were previously improperly appointed. That's how the court goes. Whereas the petitioner thought that because the initial proceeding was held by somebody not authorized to hold it, the entire proceeding is void and they should either go back and have another proceedings or really should have the whole case dismissed as a kind of as a big stick to the government, saying you just can't violate the Constitution and expect no real consequences to your cases. But that was not very heavily explored in the argument as to what happens if Lucia wins.
Yeah, the remedy portion really wasn't. One thing you said there that did come up several times, and it seemed to focus on the Social Security Administration. I'm not sure why, but that the issue of what to do with the ALJs throughout the government was real concern about that. The petitioner tried to distinguish, and the government too tried to distinguish the ALJs we're dealing with here, the SEC ALJs, from some other types of ALJs. Veterans Administration and Social Security again kept coming up. One of the distinguishing factors was that, you know, when you go to a Social Security Administration ALJ, you're petitioning for relief, whereas an SEC ALJ is, you know, summoning you in there to punish, you know, to essentially punish you for behavior you've done. And that seems like more like the sovereign doing something than petitioning for relief. The petitioner took great pains, I think, in the end, rebuttal even, had some specific numbers of cases that would be affected. His argument was that, well, our case obviously isn't final, so it makes perfect sense that you could void our case because it isn't final. There are 13 similarly situated cases, and I think he said in the the SEC's brief said there were 105 cases in some form like this, but I don't. He specifically declined to address the ALJs, sort of what would happen across the country. He replied to I think it was Justice Roberts that, you know, we're really only focused on our case,
right?
I think
there's some defensible things to saying, look, cases that are final, they're final. We sort of had the kind of very similar question arise when the Supreme Court was addressing the recess appointment power when President Obama attempted to appoint in the recess then director of the CFPB Richard Cordray and two or three members to the NLRB, which Supreme Court ultimately held was illegal because Senate was not in recess. But one of the questions that I recall from oral argument was, well, if we hold this, that these are not legal appointments, what happens to a bunch of cases that they've already adjudicated? Ultimately, kind of the same answer was given, that there's this doctrine of waiver, estoppel, et cetera. And so I think that was a concern, but ultimately probably that question is easiest to get around. The last, I think, point that at least I want to make before, I think we'll open up for question unless Kevin has some other thoughts, is that what I found fascinating, again, something not heavily explored in oral argument, although touched upon, was the government's second argument, which was not really invited, which was not part of the question presented, but the question of assuming that Lucia would win, once ALJ are appointed, they are under the current statute, they're removable only for cause. And so that creates some sort of that creates essentially a double insulation because they're appointed by, as I said, the opening Merit System Protection Board. They're selected, and Merit System Protection Board members are themselves removable only for cause. And then you can remove the ALJs for cause. So you have this double layer of insulation, similar to what Supreme Court held to be illegal and invalid under PCAOB. And of course, that was a 5-4 case, which Justice Breyer kept reminding people that he disagreed with it then and probably was right then, in part because he said this is what makes this case so difficult. But what the government has argued is that this double for cause removal is probably unconstitutional in light of PCAOB, and that instead for cause should include refusal to follow agency policy and directive, which again goes back to this question of independence. You know, what kind of directive does have to be, in a formal rule or merely commissioners directing you to do something? Who exactly gets to remove? How will it affect your decisional independence in any given case? And ultimately, why is the government making this argument in this case when this was not part of the question presented? And so I suspect, although again, we'll see how this case comes out, but I suspect that this was a strategic decision on the part of the government as part of the kind of a preview of coming attractions when a petition for certiorari is going to be filed in PHH, which is the challenge to the CFPB structure. Because obviously CFPB directors also removable only for cause. And so I think if the court addresses this question, assuming Lucia wins on question one, if the court addresses the question of what for cause means and actually interprets cause broadly, the word cause broadly, meaning that cause doesn't just mean, you know, failing to show up to the job or taking bribes or, you know, or doing things like that, actual active malfeasance, but cause means refusing to follow lawful directives, I think that will be the much bigger take-home message, much bigger revolution in administrative law than deciding whether or not ALJs are or are not officers, because ultimately that problem is fairly easily curable. You don't have the chief ALJ appoint them. You have the SEC commissioners appoint them. But the removal, if the court ever gets to it, I think that's – and like I said, there was some discussion, but not too much. But that, I think, is a much bigger to-do if the court addresses it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there seemed to be a divergence between the petitioner and the amicus on whether the ALJs had decisional independence and structural independence. You know, the petitioner thought that the decisional independence was guaranteed by the APA, but the structural independence sort of came from the appointments clause, and that was the crux of their argument, was that that, you know, you have to follow the appointments clause, and the APA is what guarantees the decisional independence. The amicus thought that they don't have decisional independence, that was the compromise of the APA, and that that, you know, the fact that the commission has to essentially approve their recommendations is almost what he said, although he didn't use that term, means that they don't actually have decisional independence. So should we open it up to questions?
I think so.
Okay, wonderful. Well, let's go ahead and open the floor then. In a moment, you'll all hear a prompt indicating the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor and present your question, just enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone. Okay, let's go ahead and move to our first audience question.
Well, I think it's time to cite Richard Epstein again, who says that there is no Article 3A in the Constitution that gives an agency, creates a fourth branch of government, which has both the power to write regulations, enforce the regulations, and then adjudge the enforcement. So, of course, if we did have Article 3 judges hearing these cases, we would not have all this trouble with the administrative law judge, who has a tendency to be either supervised or affirmed by the commissioner or reversed by the commissioner or not hired, depending on what the commissioner feels is the proper way to hire judges. Does anyone want to comment on that?
Well, first, I think it's always time to cite Richard Epstein. I don't think there's an area of the law in which Richard has not written or opined on, so there's never a bad time to cite Richard. But I think, you know, obviously it's a much bigger question as to whether or not Supreme Court got it right when it blessed back in during the New Deal administrative agency, standalone independent administrative agencies. I don't think this is the time or the place to bring it up, but I think that's a issue that will eventually bubble up, whether the court will sort of stick. I mean, obviously over time the administrative has grown, and it will be, to the extent that the court feels that it's, you know, they got it wrong, it'll be extraordinarily difficult to dismantle it. That's sort of those caveats aside, I think there have been some talk about it, including from Federal Society's own chairman of the board, Stephen Calabresi, the suggestion that ALJ should be Article 3 judges. Now, that particular proposal got a lot of play in the media as if an attempt to pack the courts, but in theory, you can have Article III judges, meaning that they serve for life and they have salary protection, but whose jurisdiction is limited, for example, to SEC cases only, in a similar way that, for example, Federal Circuit jurisdiction is limited. They don't do habeas cases. They don't do, they don't do antitrust cases generally, with some exceptions. So you can say that these are Article III judges. They are nominated by the president, confirmed by the Senate, but they will only hear SEC cases, and they'll serve for life. And that may be enough to sort of to satisfy the concern that you've raised, but also the sort of the appointments clause concern, as well as the decisional independence concern.
Yeah, but if you assume that I don't know how many ALJs are around the country, there's a lot. Imagine trying to get that many Article III judges confirmed.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's that gets to actual political realities, given the fact that they're so difficult to confirm judges as it is. You add another like couple hundred of them to the ranks and have them. I think that's absolutely true, but. But that's the trade-off. So do we want them to be administrative, whether officers or employees who are appointed without senatorial consent and serve with some modicum of protection, however much that is, depending on, again, whether the government's position on removal prevails or not. And but that's really the trade-off.
Also, the deference issue that the Article III courts tend to give great deference to these decisions by the administrative law judge, who is basically an employee of the people whose cases he's adjudging.
Right. I mean, I think, although, again, so this also came up in argument, there was an issue of like how much deference is actually given. So, for example, Justice Sotomayor brought up a point that in theory, commission reviews all the ALJ decisions de novo. Now, again, that doesn't address this particular concern because the commission, again, ultimately sits as a judge in its own case. But the commission reviews things de novo. But in reality, as was pointed out in one of the reply briefs, while that is the standard, it's very hard to review things de novo, for example, that were excluded from evidence by the ALJ. They're just not in the record. It's hard to review things really truly de novo when the commission just generally goes on paper and not doesn't actually judge credibility because they are, they didn't hear live testimony. So, and then, of course, once it gets to the Court of Appeals on a petition for review, then you also get this double level of deference, first to the trial judge or to the ALJ who made various findings of fact as well as credibility determination, and then to the agency under various doctrines of deference that when agencies can be set aside. So that does create some problems for litigants in terms of getting their cases heard from kind of on a blank slate from by Article III judge. But that's kind of I don't think this is the case that will address administrative states writ large.
Yeah, that's also another. Your arguments are very good arguments for making all these judges Article III judges.
Thank you, caller, for your question.
Hi, this is Ken Cuccinelli, I wanted to just ask each of you what you think the most likely outcomes of this are.
Kevin, you want to take this first?
Yeah, I mean, I think going into it, the Freytag case sort of laid the groundwork for where this is going to end up. I think that the commission will win this one this time because they've switched sides. I think that they're going to find that the ALJs are inferior officers. I think really, in my mind, the debate is what happens and what's the remedy. I think they'll make it very limited. There's some authority out there for staying a lot of current ALJ decisions to try and figure out what to do. Let the government, maybe Congress, come up with a statute. But I think based on what I heard today and what I saw, it's going to end up that way. I know it's a fool's errand to try and predict what the court's going to do. But Justice Kagan's question about aren't we almost on all – basically she said isn't this almost on all fours with Freytag says to me that that's where she's going to go.
So, I don't play the lottery for the same reason I generally don't predict Supreme Court decisions because it's just very hard, especially in cases that are – ultimately fairly complex. But, since I'm not being charged for playing this game right now, I'll give, I guess, my two cents. So I think Kevin is right. So Justice Kagan did seem to recognize that this is very similar to Freytag. At the same time, she did say that the amicus's test, the one that actually defends the status quo, made sense to her if she was writing in a blank slate. So then the question is she more going to be pulled by the stare decisis features of our system, or more by, you know, the original understanding of, you know, what an employee is, what a government is, or for that matter, by the functional understanding as to whether or not the system can work the way as intended with all these ALJs becoming officers. But I think what's more interesting, and I think that's actually more interesting but also more murky, is not how this case will come out in terms of top line, who's going to win, is it going to be affirmed or reversed. But I think what's more interesting is if it's reversed, if these ALJs are going to be held to be inferior officers, is going to be the question of remedy and whether or not it's just going to be anything more than a hollow victory where the court will say, yes, they're inferior officers, no, they were not properly appointed, but guess what? It's a very easy fix. Have the commission get together, vote to essentially reappoint them or appoint them properly or to ratify the previously improper appointment, and that way bless everything they've done up until now. If that's the outcome, then yes, the top line is from now on these individuals will be appointed differently, but nothing really will change on the ground. And I think there's some kind of precedent for that, perhaps not judicial, but there was a few years ago, Professor John Duffy noticed the same similar problem in the Patent and Trademark Office, where the patent judges were not appointed by the head of the patent office, nor by the by the Department of Commerce. Actually published a law review article before it got to the court to obviate any challenges. They were kind of retroactively appointed by the head of the department. So there's some precedent for this kind of backward-looking blessing of previously improper appointments. Whether the court will endorse it or not, I think is going to be a much more consequential part of this decision than whether or not what the top line is.
Thank you for your question, caller. Looks like we do have one more question. Let's go ahead and move to the next caller.
Yes, John Burlaw, the Competitive Enterprise Institute. How are you doing? I'm just, as far as not just appointments clause cases, but separation of powers cases when something was unconstitutionally structured, I think maybe a more recent precedent is the Noel Canning case and what actually happened there when they ruled that the NLRB had a defective structure because of the illegal recess appointments. Did that have any bearing on the cases that had been decided by the NLRB?
My recollection is, Kevin, if you want, you can go ahead and.
I was glad you were starting with your recollection because I was.
So my recollection is that once the court decided, so the two things happened. One is the case that had already been decided and were final. I think they remained final because there was. I do remember in the oral argument there was some in that case there was some concern, not only what's going to happen to in the last. Whatever it was, like 2 years or a year and a half between the recent appointment and the time it came up to the court, but also what's going to happen to the previous 100 years, because I don't know if you recall, but one of the arguments was that it's not just the Senate was not on recess at that time, but also that recess only means intersession recess, not intra-session recess, and actually four justices bought that argument. So they, Justice Scalia writing for the four justice minority on that. And so there was a concern as to what's going to happen to the last 100-odd years of people who acted perhaps improperly appointed. And the court said, look, there's waiver, there's estoppel, and so on. But what happened to the cases that were still pending in front of the improperly constituted NLRB is that those cases, where basically had to go back and start from scratch. And NLRB was, new people were nominated. Then Majority Leader Reid struck a deal with Senate Republicans that they will not filibuster nominees in exchange for the improperly appointed nominees being withdrawn and resubmitted. Conversely, what happened with CFPB is that because it ended up being the same guy, so Richard Cordray was nominated and held the office as an recent appointment, whose appointment was obviously also illegal under the logic of Noel Canning. But then ultimately was confirmed and by the Senate. He basically ratified his own prior decision, unsurprisingly, right? And so that was not really – but those were not really adjudicatory. Those were kind of – he had made a bunch of rules as a recent appointee, and then he said all the rules that I made as a recent appointee, I now reconfirm. I remake them as a properly appointed and confirmed individual. And that has not been if I remember, I could be wrong, but I don't think that has been challenged, that kind of this – backwards looking ratification. But again, those were the rules versus adjudications, and so that may play out a little differently on cases that are not yet final. But that's my recollection.
So could pending cases have to go back and start from scratch again if it's ruled unconstitutional, if the structure is unconstitutional?
It might, but then there's – so the commission has already – and so this was actually brought up, and this was in the briefs as well – the commission has already, as this case was winding its way up, the commission had already, as of today, they have ratified appointments of ALJs as if they're been appointed by the commission. Whether that's enough, whether they can do it, not just going forward, but going backwards for cases that already had been heard by ALJs, but not yet final, I think that's what I was talking about in response to the last question. What will be the remedy? Can a hearing in front of an improperly appointed official, a hearing that has serious consequences in terms of evidence included in terms of credibility judgments, can that be ratified backwards? And so that on that issue, we'll see.
Yeah, it's sort of an odd thing, right? If it's determined to have been constitutionally feeble the way they did it, it seems odd that you could just ratify something and say, my bad, and move on. But it may be the practical reality of what has to happen.
But it potentially is silly the other way too. So there are really no good answers, right? Because in theory, they can ratify them going forward, and then say, well, I have to do the hearing again, but potentially assign it to the same person. And of course, the same person would probably take the same view that he did 2 months ago, 3 months ago, or a year ago. There's no particular reason why he said, well, before I was unconstitutionally appointed, so I viewed this evidence in this light, but now that I have been appointed by the commission itself, I have totally different view of the same evidence. So it ultimately may play out much the same no matter what, except perhaps in Lucia's own case, because at least they've urged the justices in their briefs, whether the justice will take the invitation or not, but they've urged the justice in their briefs as a punishment for the commission to show the commission and the government that the Constitution actually means something, to outright dismiss their case, even though it could, in theory, be heard before a properly appointed ALJ.
Thank you.
Thank you, caller, for your question. Kevin, is there anything that you would like to comment on that you haven't yet, or any closing remarks that you'd like to make before we finish today?
No, just thanks very much for the opportunity. I enjoyed the teleform and certainly gave me a reason to go sit and listen to the arguments, which I really enjoyed.
Wonderful. Well, thank you. And Professor Dolan, do you have anything that you'd like to say, any comments or closing remarks?
Like I said before, I think what I would be really looking for as the decision comes down is much less of a top line and any hints on what's going to, like I said, the common attractions, the PHH case, the sort of the general removal power, and the scope of executive authority to supervise the executive branch, and whether or not the true independence of agencies is potentially on deck to be reviewed by this court in future cases. I think that's going to be a much more interesting thing to look for. Other than that, I'm very grateful to the Federal Society for inviting me. It's always fun to do these, and for the questions, as well as for Kevin for helping me along with this and being a great partner.
On behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us today. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast.
For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.